begin when, in thinking about gram-negative pathogens, what types of resistance are the most prevalent you are seeing in your institution?
So we've had some changes during COVID, which has been really disappointing. Certainly in Sacramento, where I'm at, we've had some of our smaller hospitals, their antibiogram and resistance profile actually got a bit better. We've actually seen things get a little bit worse, unfortunately. And really the biggest one that's concerning us is just carbapenem resistance among the gram negatives. And that has increased. Not surprisingly, we're a teaching institution. We had a lot of patients that were with us for a while early on in COVID on mechanical ventilation, on ECMO. Therefore, you get multiple courses of antimicrobials. As such, we just saw resistance increasing. And really, you know, the big one is our carbapenem susceptibilities declined during that period. We are seeing a slight change in our aminoglycoside resistance. We've actually been really pretty susceptible to aminoglycosides, particularly with the Enterobacter alice. That's maybe gone down a little bit, and I would say that's probably a second area of concern for us because we rely on the aminoglycosides pretty heavily for urine-associated multi-drug resistant organisms. So I think that's been a challenge.
Absolutely. And thinking about microbiology resources, can you talk a little bit about that in your institution and what role do they play in determining your treatment protocol?
Yeah, we, you know, stewardship is like every place, it's really important to us. But I'm, you know, there's some days there's not a lot I'm proud of, but I'm definitely very proud of our stewardship program, and that's often driven a lot by our culture and microbiology data. So really making sure that we have adequate, you know, culture results, that's really the big thing. So that's sort of twofold. One is just the old garden variety cultures. So if we get a sputum or urine culture, you know, determining which organisms they are and as quickly as possible, I think that's been helpful. On the blood isolate side, we have much more rapid diagnostic testing that's PCR based. So that not only gets us the specific organism, but we can screen for some of the bigger factors for antimicrobial resistance. So whether there's a particular ESBL present, that'll be screened as well. So I think that's been really helpful. So we have all those main resources, and that's probably been one of our big strengths, is that we're able to get those resources quickly. How we manage those resources are a little bit different. So from the diagnostic standpoint, we may decide to limit culturing in some areas. We may be more aggressive in culturing in others. So an example is, you know, you can't really order a urine culture in our institution unless you have a urine analysis. Sounds really stupid and simple, but if we get a urine culture and it shows some organisms, we may not know if that's asymptomatic bacteriuria, which, you know, again, doesn't necessarily need treatment, or is that actually a UTI? And sometimes that's hard, especially in patients who are delirious, can't give us the results, and then that really drives our treatment protocols very closely. So making sure that our diagnostic testing is tied to our microbiology testing, it's done appropriately in concert when the symptoms are there, I think has really been key.
Absolutely, and of course we're talking about diagnostics here, and you mentioned a little bit about stewardship. Do you think this is an area within the industry, the medical industry, it's making inroads in increasing efficiencies to time to optimal treatment?
I do. You know, when we look at our stewardship, there's a couple things which have been really helpful for us, and aggressive de-escalation. And, you know, being a critical care physician in our critical care world, time is of the essence. So if you have an unstable patient, they're meeting all the criteria for septic shock, you're going to broadly cover them from gram positives and gram negatives. If they have multiple risk factors for drug resistance, whether it's a prolonged ICU stay, multiple courses of prior antimicrobials, you may go very broad initially. So it might take 3, 4, 5 days for the cultures to come back, either negative or with a specific organism, and then you're going to de-escalate and tailor therapy appropriately. Anything that can shorten that timeline is helpful. And what often happens is we don't want to go broad because we don't want to use too many antimicrobials. Sometimes we go narrow. If we go too narrow, we miss the appropriate bugs. So by going broad and then being able to de-escalate quickly, I think is key. So some of those diagnostics will really help greatly. We mentioned some of the, you know, rapid diagnostic testing for you know, blood cultures. We actually surprisingly do PCR testing for Clostridium difficile. So we do that on a lot of our at-risk and high-risk admissions, and very often most of our patients. That's been really great. Sounds crazy, but if you're PCR positive for Clostridium difficile, you're asymptomatic, you don't have diarrhea, we haven't done toxin testing, but we know the organism's present. Just talking to our physicians and saying, listen, do you really need that antibiotic? Can we tailor to the most narrow therapy? Because the last thing we want to give the patient is C. diff. These are the sort of simple things that have really helped greatly. And then presenting the data has been helpful as well. So For example, we might test on a really broad panel for some of our gram negatives. We have a Pseudomonas come back. We'll test for cefepime, piperacillin tazobactam, meropenem, ceftaz avibactam, ceftolazane tazobactam. But we're only going to show the most, you know, for lack of a better term, the lowest common result. So if it's piperacillin tazobactam susceptible, why are we going to show meropenem and ceftaz avibactam and all the others? Because we want that most narrow spectrum. So we choose to show, you know, what we kind of want our physicians to see. And I think that's actually been helpful. It sounds crazy, but, you know, if we give them a big menu, they're going to pick what they want. This way, we actually don't have to call them after the fact and say, hey, why are you on this antimicrobial? We have a more narrow choice, and it allows for that.
Absolutely. And in thinking about hospitalization and things like hospital-acquired bacterial pneumonia and ventilator-associated bacterial pneumonia, what are some of the risk factors you look to prioritize when seeing these patients?
Yeah, and this risk factor analysis is kind of key because we often don't know what bug a person has, but we need to obviously choose the right antimicrobial. And if you look at the SCCM guidelines, you know, they will say, you know, choose a very broad, aggressive approach. If you look at the IDSA guidelines, they want risk factors involved in that. I think that's a smart choice because, you know, if your patient walks in off the street, has no risk factors for multi-drug resistance, you're not going to go with a very broad anti-pseudomonal, gram-negative in that case. You're really going to be very judicious and do something like ceftriaxone, for example, if they have community-acquired pneumonia. So we try to do the same at every point during their hospital stay by presenting those risks. So if they're at day 5 of their ICU stay and they're on mechanical ventilation, you know, Pseudomonas is a possibility, but is a multi-drug resistant Acinetobacter likely? Probably not. And then we at least at each point try and use these risk factors as a discussion. So the big ones is, you know, how long have you been in our institution? So is it an ICU or non-ICU length of stay? What courses of antimicrobials have you had in the past? What are your prior cultures showing? So if you were in our institution 3 months prior and you had a carbapenem resistant Acinetobacter, that's likely to be present as well. And then most importantly, where are you coming from? So some of our nursing homes in our community have high rates of carbapenem resistance. They might have an Acinetobacter outbreak. Others might not. And then that knowing where you're coming from also can help us tailor our therapy. So we try and feed that data back to our physicians. Then they can make a judicious approach, get the appropriate coverage up front, but not overshoot and have inappropriate use of antimicrobials. So the risk factors really guide those in those early days before the diagnostic testing comes back.
And in thinking about risk factors, is it pretty well laid out in your institution in terms of thinking about, okay, we have a certain setup here, as far as the standard of care, the way we think about risk factors, how does that work as far as risk factors?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's it works twofold. One is we try to meet with our physicians and teach them up front that to say, okay, you know, this guy has been, you know, has severe COVID pneumonia, is trached, has been in our ICU for 60 days. Their likelihood of having a carbapenem resistant gram negative is high. Someone's been here 5 or 7 days, their likelihood of having a carbapenem resistance gram negative is lower, right? So we do some basic teaching like that. The other mechanism is actually on the backside, where we, on the antimicrobial stewardship side, actually reach out to the physicians and talk to them one-on-one. And that's our big role. So we may, for example, if someone comes in and they've, you know, been in the ICU for 60 days and they start piperacillin tazobactam for, you know, a new onset fever, cough, sputum production, we may actually call them up and say, listen, they've been here for 60 days, they've had multiple courses of a carbapenem. We need to start looking at a carbapenem-resistant gram-negative. And, you know, hey, if the culture comes back in 3 days and piperacillin tazobactam works great, awesome, we'll de-escalate. But at least you have multiple risk factors present. Let's transition over to that agent, or vice versa. And it's some one-on-one education, and some of it is through grand rounds. It's through guideline use. We're pretty aggressive at using our EMR. We have Epic, and if you're going to go in and write for an antimicrobial at our institution, we'll put in the antimicrobial. We actually ask how you're using it, and if one of the selections is empiric, that automatically kicks it over to a pharmacy review. The third question will then be, where do you think the site of infection is? And say, for example, if you pick lung, ventilator-associated pneumonia, our guidelines will pop up on the side. And within those guidelines, they'll have, you know, those risk factors, length of stay, prior antibiotic use, prior culture, you know, results in the last 6 months. So then you can at least make your best guess. So it's some education up front, it's some presentation in the EMR, and then on the back end, it's us doing that education as well.
Absolutely. And thinking about therapies, because we've been talking about, are there any particular investigational or approved therapies you're excited about? You know, thinking about the gram-negative side of things mostly.
Yeah, there's obviously some, and we've kind of come a long way. And when I first finished my ID in critical care training, when we had someone who had carbapenem resistance, I got used to using colistin, tigecycline, some of these agents, which were sometimes hard to use. We have multiple choices now. So I think, there's some of the tried and true ones, like ceftazavibactam, ceftolazane tazobactam. There's certainly the carbapenem bases paired with the ESBL inhibitors like meropenem, vaborbactam, and imipenem, morelabactam. And those have been, obviously pretty strong agents for us. As we went through COVID, we started seeing some resistance in those agents. So we have had, we're still excited about their use, finding the right occasion, finding the occasions where resistance may present itself, particularly if it's a KPC on active therapy, where that may come in. The two other areas where we're actually interested, sifidricol, which is a newer antimicrobial, it's a CYTA4 antimicrobial, particularly for Acinetobacter. There's some data that's coming out now with some real world experience showing some good outcomes for use with Acinetobacter or with Stenotrophomonas, particularly if they're sulfur resistant, and we have some limited choices there. That's a therapy I'm excited about. Amatocycline, which is an oral tetracycline, it's an aminomethacycline. Generally, we don't think of oral agents in this space, but for, certainly we've used it for mycobacterial disease in the ID world, but for some of these high producing ESBLs, particularly in the Enterobacter aureus realm, it provides some oral therapy. And for some of our patients who may not quite be intubated, have resistance, that's been one we've been excited about. And there's been some data recently coming out here at ID Week, sort of supporting the use in those spaces.
Absolutely. And thinking about therapies in the pipeline when it comes to these challenging infections, how would you characterize how we're doing in terms of these therapies in the pipeline? Do you feel like you're, optimistic, or how do you feel about things coming down the pike?
I would say I'm probably mildly pessimistic. And, I think there's options. We're going to see some new agents coming out down the line. I think it's exciting having some of these new agents, and we haven't really seen expanding resistance very rapidly, but the development of resistance, particularly during COVID for some of these new agents, is concerning. I think, the nice part with the keynotes, one of the keynote speeches here at ID Week was Helen Boucher, and she sort of mentioned, hey, this is the anniversary. We're coming up here in November on the four-year anniversary for the last gram-negative antimicrobial that had approval. So it's almost been 4 years since we've had anything approved. Now, granted, COVID throws a wrinkle into things, and that made things a bit harder, but I think the slight pessimism comes for, I don't know what's on the horizon. We don't see something that's going to be approved in the next, 6, 12, 18 months that's coming in front of the FDA. So that's where my slight pessimism comes. I'm optimistic because we haven't seen, expanding resistance. A lot of the susceptibility data, which you might have seen with amatocycline, ceftazavibactam, ceftolazane, tazobactam, sifidricol, all of that presented here at ID Week showed really good susceptibility still in general. So that's my optimism. My pessimism is, what do we see in the pipeline that is really going to be coming in the next couple, years, and I don't see a whole lot. And that's my worry.
Yeah, and in terms of looking at it from a standpoint of like what's going to help motivate, companies to get back in the space, so to speak, do you think there's any one or a couple of things that we might be able to point to that might be helpful to kind of push that development along, if you will?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, this development is so complicated, and I think that's the part that's really difficult. I actually don't know if I have a good answer, which would put, one solid answer that would push companies in that direction. Being involved in clinical trials at my institution, you see what goes into a clinical trial. You see how much money and time is invested. So it's not just price, it's just time. And then you don't really know necessarily what that endpoint is. Will it be successful? Will it not? Even if you meet non-inferiority, where's that space going to sort of go? And I think the real difficulty is along those lines. From our side of things as providers, we're always going to do what's the least expensive, right? So when we build our antibiogram, susceptibility matters. But within the world, if we have all things created equal, price drives it. And we know that in the healthcare world. And somehow we need to get over that where, we may look away from price, which would be awesome, but doesn't always happen. But we may look away from price and choose something that actually improves patient throughput and makes us money in another area. So an example that I always mention for us is, vancomycin is exceedingly expensive, right? But if I have to keep someone in my hospital for 2 weeks getting IV vancomycin, right, because they're at risk or they're a drug user, I can't send them home, or they have an unstable home environment, that's fine, but that's 2 weeks in the hospital, right? We may choose a newer antimicrobial that has an oral option, right, or has a different once daily dose acting or long acting. We may choose that. Yeah, that's more money, but that really frees up our hospital. So for the healthcare system, for our institution, for the patient, it's better. So we need to think outside of that cost in a different way. And I think that would help probably in the development, because we look at things as agents of throughput. We look at things as opening up healthcare access, not so much, hey, this is a new antimicrobial, costs a lot of money, we need to restrict it, in which case we get in that dichotomy that's been there for decades, which then limits development for many places. Antibiotics are a hard thing to sell. It's a job I would never want, right? Because as a steward, I'm going to use the most narrow agent I can for the shortest amount of time possible. So how do you sell that to someone when I don't want to use it and I don't want to use it for very long? And that's just the way stewardship is. So somehow we have to think of it differently so people are willing to develop it in different manners. So
it's interesting that you mentioned you're taking a holistic approach when you said you're looking at the patient profile, and where, you know, you had said you might have somebody who may not have a stable home life and you won't want to leave them in the hospital for 2 weeks on vancomycin. And, you know, you might be inclined to do oral. It really kind of goes to like a different way of, you know, the approach of thinking about it. Do you think it's more of a novel approach, or do you think it's more like something that a lot of institutions are doing in terms of taking a look at the patient profile in that regard?
I don't actually see a lot of people doing that. I think the problem with healthcare is we're so siloed, right? And I can't blame pharmacy. I can't blame any part of healthcare, really. You know, pharmacy might have their budget and they live within their budget. And that's what, you know, for example, at our institution, our CEO sends that down. They have a budget. They're sort of forced to live within that budget. So if they have one antimicrobial that's cost a lot of money, one that's really cheap, you know, they're going to be judged on their budget. They're going to use the one that's cheap, but it might have, you know, or less expensive, I should say, really, you know, cheap is doesn't sound right. But, you know, in those cases, they're going to use the less expensive antimicrobial, but it might have downstream effects. Longer length of stay, right? More lab studies ordered, an invasive central line, you know, whatever it may be. And there's really no one at the high level looking at those downstream effects where, hey, I might invest a little more money here, but I'm going to save in this area. And that's as just savings. But the other area is that what's better for the patient, right? Do they really want to sit in the hospital for 2 weeks and then pick up Pseudomonas? Or, you know, is it better for them to actually leave? So it's really balancing those out. And very often there's not someone that's patient-centric at the high level looking at what's best, you know, for the system, both from a financial stewardship but a patient stewardship. And I just don't see many places, and that's hard. And it's just the structure of healthcare makes it very difficult.